Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, September 4th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times, CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Mike Dean up at the State House. A lot to get to this week. Primary elections took place on Tuesday, and we saw really an unprecedented voter turnout. Only turns out a good portion of those voters didn't actually come to the polls. Jeff Spillane of the Cape Cod Times joins us to talk about the election and results. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Jeff, let's start off by talking about the high turnout. This was a different kind of election in terms of process, and not just for voters, also for town clerks.
It was, and it certainly was a higher than average turnout for a primary, especially in a presidential year. I'm not talking about the presidential primary itself, but a primary, a state primary election, a presidential year. Typically, we see about 25% turnout in those years. And across the Cape, we were seeing turnout in the 40%, 50% range, much higher than usual. And you're right, it's attributable to the ability to vote early this year and to vote by mail. This was the first state primary election where early voting has been allowed. So that is what would get some of those numbers up. Spoke with Barnesville Town Clerk Ann Quirk, as a matter of fact, earlier this morning. They're right now hovering about a 40% turnout. They're waiting for it to finalize all the numbers. And once again, she said typically about 25%, so much higher turnout. But there's something interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say a lot more work for town clerks because of the mail-in ballots.
Oh my gosh, a lot more work, and I know in working with some of these clerks over the course of the past week that they were really burning the midnight oil. It's not as if you're walking into a school gym or cafeteria, checking in, checking out, putting your ballot in a machine. You have to get an application to vote early. It needs to come in to the town clerk's office. It needs to be opened. It needs to be logged in, processed. It needs to be barcoded. Then you need to send it out again. Then it needs to come back. By my estimation, it's about 10 extra steps per ballot. So these folks were really, really working very hard to get this done. And very, very time consuming. And they knew that right from the beginning. As a matter of fact, Bill Galvin, our Secretary of State here in Massachusetts, that was one of his biggest fears. And but it seems to have paid off here at least. Mm. But one thing we're seeing, Steve, and I wanted to mention this, as far as request for mail-in ballots, very, very high. As of Monday, the day before the election, there had been 9,800 or so applications received in Barnstable. Only 6,000 came back. So I'm going to be looking at that data this week to see, you know, how many of these mail-in ballots actually got returned, which is, I think, very interesting. And one of the town clerks said, if you're going to ask for it, use it.
Let's talk results here and briefly start with the state Senate race, the big Senate race, I should say. The incumbent Ed Markey won handily across the state and across the Cape and Islands.
He did. And, you know, a lot of people perceive Cape Cod as Kennedy country, and they have for decades. But if you look at the numbers here, Markey did win. It was about a 54-46% victory for Ed Markey down here. And of course, he visited Falmouth about 2 days before the election, 3 days before the election. Had a great turnout. I was right there. But looking at the numbers here on the Cape, Joe Kennedy, he did win Barnstable. Of course, Hyannisport is a village of Barnstable, but not by much. He also won Dennis, Mashpee, and Yarmouth, and that was it. So that's an interesting side story developing.
Taking a look at the local races, the 5th Barnstable Republican primary was one of our more high-profile contests. Stephen Exaris won here. This is for a seat that Hunt had, and he's retiring now.
That's right. Randy Hunt has decided not to run for re-election, largely in part because of the tenor of public politics right now in the United States. This one, I think, was a lot closer than people had anticipated. It was a race between Stephen Exaros, the former deputy chief of the Yarmouth Police Department, very well known, a lot of people know his name, against Tom Keyes, who is a he's run several times before. The race did take a very very contentious tone in the last week or two, each one of them attacking each other for issues of integrity, et cetera. And what this came down to, Steve, I think, was the town of Sandwich. It encompassed the whole town of Sandwich, a couple of precincts in Barnstable-Bourne and Plymouth. And Keyes is from Sandwich, where Exaros is from West Barnstable. And Steve Exaros, he won handily by like almost an 80 to 20% margin in Sandwich. And that really sealed the deal for him. And we had that election called at about 9 o'clock, which is a lot earlier than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
The county against Democrat Jim Dever, by the way.
Oh, right. Yes, thank you for that. The county commissioner race on the Democratic side, also a high-profile contest. There were three candidates for two positions.
Yeah, and you don't see a lot of interest in county positions like this, but this year it was very high-profile. Two positions up, two seats available this year. It was against Cheryl Andrews from Provincetown, very well-known on the Outer Cape, was a former selectman there. She did not make the cut. She came in third place, got about 27% of the vote. By the way, this is a very close race. These three candidates are very close together. But the two Democrats will be on the ballot in November. It's Mark Forrest. He is a selectman in the town of Yarmouth and is also a former assistant to Congressman Bill Delahunt for years. Once again, very well known. And then we have Sheila Lyons, who topped all of the vote getters in that race. She actually had served as county commissioner for two terms from 2008 to 2016. So Mark Forrest and Sheila Lyons move on, and they're going to be facing Republican Ron Beatty, the controversial county commissioner who's been in office since 2016. And then there is an independent candidate, Abe Kasparian, out of Yarmouth. So that's going to be another interesting race, given the controversy surrounding the incumbent.
Jeff, we have just about a minute left, but I want to mention the second Barnstable District, kind of a battle between write-in candidates there.
Yeah, very much so. Very unusual. But that race went to Kip Diggs, and he really, really went big there. It was about, and once again, 80 to 20%. And for those of you who don't know Kip Diggs, he is a former world welterweight boxing champion in the mid-1990s, very well known in Barnstable, and he did defeat Michael Cenas. Michael is a leader of the Brazilian community in Hyannis. Another odd story here. Michael was already going to be on the ballot as an independent. He decided, well, you know what, let me write in as a Democrat, because that will take somebody out of the race so we have a better chance of beating incumbent Will Crocker. And he decided late last night, he informed us that he is suspending his campaign. Mm. Although I'm trying to figure out at this moment, I have a call in to Boston, if it's too late or not to have his name removed as an independent. So this saga continues.
It's Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times joining us this morning. Jeff, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Cape Cod Healthcare is laying off 118 employees. This story broke late last week after our program, so I wanted to take a moment to make sure we talked about it. Joining us is WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, good to be here.
Jeanette, what did Cape Cod Healthcare tell us about the people who are losing their jobs here? Who are they?
Well, 40 of that 118, so about a third, are unionized service workers. That includes people in food service, people who do cleaning, and lab technicians. There is one nurse, part-time nurse at Falmouth Hospital, who was part of that group. And the rest, so about two-thirds of the overall number, they say are non-union and senior management positions. And I think it's noticeable that eight of those are vice presidents whose positions have been eliminated since the beginning of the pandemic. So they have lost eight vice presidents.
So this is a result, obviously, of the pandemic. Tell us, what's the financial situation at Cape Cod Healthcare that made this necessary, and what other steps are they thinking of taking?
Well, they've lost a lot of revenue. $111 million is what they're down, and the CEO does emphasize that they had to they had to close off the elective procedures and things like that. It was a state mandate. Basically, that's the loss of patient volume in both those elective procedures and other things is what's driving that loss. Patient volume is off in the double digits for the year across the major departments of Cape Cod Healthcare, emergency, and things like that. One other thing they're doing is cutting pay again for the senior management, which they've done before. So 20 people in senior management, including Mike Loft, the CEO, are taking 10% pay cuts for their new fiscal year, which starts soon in October.
Also this week, you took a look at a different story. The Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce talked about some of the economic impacts of the pandemic on the local region, more broadly than just the healthcare. What did we hear from the chamber?
The chamber has a really big board, 29 members in the business community, and they met this week and compared notes about what they're seeing in the local economy. The director, Wendy Northcross, tells me that some types of businesses are doing much better than others. Maybe not a surprise here, but she says those things are home sales, short-term rentals, which we've heard a lot about that being busy this season, car sales, and boat sales. So things maybe that people have been, you know, more interested in spending time on because of the pandemic. But on the other side, there are businesses that are not doing as well at all, and those are kind of other types of retail, small stores, and she mentioned restaurants also, if they're restaurants that have not been able to do a lot with outdoor seating, then they are hurting as well.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us this morning. Jeanette, thank you for that.
Thanks.
A property described as one of the most important tracts of land in the Commonwealth is on Martha's Vineyard, and it will be preserved from development under a new deal. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with the story. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, tell us about this property. It's Redgate Farm.
Yeah, so this is Redgate Farm. It's a property that has historically been owned by the Kennedy family. Originally, it was Jackie Onassis Kennedy, who purchased the property, I believe, for $1 million. But over the years, it's become sort of a private retreat for the Kennedys, and now it's currently owned by Caroline, her daughter. The property went on the market last year for $65 million, and it's this enormous property out in Aquinna that, as you said, has been described by sort of the Massachusetts conservation agencies as one of the most important tracts of land in the Commonwealth. The property is about 340 acres, I believe. Yeah, it's 340 acres. And the way this purchase is working is that Sheriff's Meadow and the Martha's Vineyard Land Bank are going to be buying approximately 300 acres of the undeveloped land. And then the Kennedy family is going to retain ownership of the part of the property sort of in the middle that their buildings and homes are on. So they are going to retain a part, but pretty much the vast majority, including the part that has, you know, beachfront access, a lot of access to the Squibnocket Pond, all of that is going to be public conservation land, which is really exciting.
It looks, just from some of the photographs, like just sort of basically a pristine stretch of coastline. That's what is making this so, both that and the fact that it's such a big parcel, that's what makes this land so important. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said that it's pristine. You know, a lot of properties that are 300 acres large on the vineyard are not completely undeveloped at this point, especially one out in Aquinna, which already is a small part of the island, but it's also one of the most geologically and ecologically significant parts of the island. You know, it was formed by glacial moraine. It looks different than a lot of the islands. Instead of having sort of taller trees and forest, it's more filled with sort of, it's more scrubby, and it's unique. It is globally unique and rare. And you're right, the sort of tract along the ocean, at least the part that's beachfront access, is completely pristine. And, you know, it's about a half mile of south-facing beachfront, which, which sort of speaks for itself. Anyone who's been to the vineyard knows.
On the vineyard, especially, yes.
Right.
Tell us about how the Sheriff's Meadow Foundation and the Vineyard Land Bank got together on this. This is an unusual partnership to be working together, right?
Right. I mean, it is in that sense sort of a first of its kind partnership. The property was on the market for $65 million, so it would have been, I think, a challenge for one of the conservation organizations to outright purchase it themselves. But working together, the way this is going to happen is that Sheriff's Meadow is going to contribute $12 million, which they are fundraising. I believe they've fundraised about $9 million of that already. And then the land bank is going to contribute $15 million to the purchase. And then the way they're going to own it and manage it is going to be sort of in a 50, 54%, 66%, where it breaks down proportionally to how much they purchased. Yeah, something like this has really never happened before. And at least for Sheriff Meadow, this is probably, I mean, their executive director said it's perhaps the most significant acquisition in their history. It's similar to the preservation or the effort to preserve Cedar Tree Neck Sanctuary, which is on the other side of the island. And for the land bank, they actually were able to work with Martha's Vineyard Bank to secure the $15 million through a loan, which I think is actually going to make it more affordable for them in terms of interest and whatnot than from if they issued a revenue bond, which the land bank is that when they're making large purchases, that's actually sort of that's the route they traditionally do take. But this, it keeps the money on the islands in a lot of ways, and it really is sort of talking to the people who were involved in the transaction, they see it as a future step for conservation. If land organizations can work together in this effort, then I think it's more likely that they're going to be able to step up and purchase a property like this, especially when it sounds like the Kennedys had multiple offers coming from a million different directions and ended up going with the conservation route. At least that
And
was the sense. Right. Go ahead.
they ended up dropping that price significantly. I mean, from a
True.
$65 million asking price to selling it at $27 million.
True. And we don't know exactly what happened in between. but you're right. It was significantly lower, which, it's a testament. I think the Kennedys really did want the land to be preserved, at least certain parts of it, most definitely.
It's
And for the
Noah
islands.
Asimo. Yes, and for the islands. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette, thanks so much for joining us on that.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Four employees of the Chatham Squire restaurant tested positive for COVID. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with that story and more. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, town officials have given the Squire credit for how they've handled this situation. Tell us what we know about how this unfolded.
What we know is that apparently on Sunday, management of the Squire learned that one staff member had tested positive for COVID. The Main Street restaurant, you probably know it. Many people know it. It's probably the highest profile restaurant in Chatham. You go almost anywhere in the world and say you're from Chatham, and people will say, "Oh, I've been to the Squire." They had to shut down and did some deep cleaning on Sunday evening and opened again Monday. But they had, at the same time, they sent 15 more staff members to be tested who had apparently been in contact with the other person who tested positive. And three of those people ended up having positive tests. And so on Tuesday, again, the restaurant was closed, and Wednesday, and they did again deep cleaning and disinfecting in accordance with state guidelines and protocols. At this point, what we know is that one of those infected employees was a Chatham resident. According to town officials, two were from Harwich and one is from South Yarmouth. This isn't the first time that someone who's tested positive who worked in a restaurant has resulted in local restaurants being closed. If you remember back in July, Steve, there was that party in Chatham, which resulted in a cluster of 13 positive cases. And many of those people were restaurant workers. And six local restaurants had to close because of that situation. Now, town officials say, as you mentioned, Steve, the squire was very cooperative, and they've been in almost constant contact with the town's health department, and they followed all the guidelines and rules that are set out for how to handle a situation like that. And on Thursday, the squire was open again, and there were lines of people waiting to get in.
Tim, the Harwich Town Seal is coming under scrutiny for its depiction of Native American dwelling, which is inaccurate. Some are calling for an update. We have just about a minute. Can you just give us a quick summary of what this story looks like?
Sure. That town seal, which actually was adopted 123 years ago today, shows in part a Native American standing next to a teepee. But as you said, that's not accurate. The Wampanoag people from this area lived in wetus, round houses. And David Whedon of the Historical Preservationist for the Wampanoag Tribe in Mashpee said that is not a correct depiction on the seal, and he also questioned the depiction of the clothing that the native person is wearing. Town officials said that they're willing to look at making a change if this is the case. Chairman of Selectmen Larry Ballantyne said he'd be interested in talking to Whedon about this and looking into whether there should be a change or not. As an aside, this seal was designed by Charles Cahoon, who is one of the best-known artists from Harwich around that time. And probably just pulled the teepee out of the representation that people had at the time and even today of sort of the Plains Indians teepees. But it's not accurate, and there's going to be I expect an effort to make some kind of change to that seal.
It's Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Provincetown is about to experience a landmark change. The Provincetown town crier is retiring. To explain what this is about, we're joined by Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Good. Marianne, Ken Lonergan is the town crier. Tell us about Ken and how he came to the job and how he's really established himself in the community.
Well, let's see. He came to the job in 2007, so he's been on the job for 13 years. He, if you ever have encountered him, he's really kind of a funny, spontaneous guy, super welcoming. And I think, everybody who's ever, come to Provincetown from a ferry or met him on Commercial Street, you really immediately, you're like, you just think, like you just think highly of him immediately. He's always dressed in the pilgrim outfit. He has a bell that he's always ringing, and he has this slogan. It's called "All is well," and it says "All is well in Provincetown because you're here." And those particular words, I think it kind of establishes the sense, important sense that he has, that he wants to welcome people, and I think that's probably how he's established himself. Over the years.
The towns used to have criers, and they were actually part of their function was to distribute the news to towns members. This is a different version of what a town crier does, right? And he kind
right.
of took this up and kind of crafted this role for himself.
No, that's true. So like before he was reading about it, I believe, and he in 2006, and he ended up asking around about the job. But before that, like the town hadn't had one in 20 years. And as you said, the original function, I think even dating back to the mid 1800s, was around, distributing. The town crier cried out the news per se, but he's more, I think he really had to kind of figure it out for himself over the years. And he is definitely a welcoming person. It's a seasonal job, so it's in the summer only. So he's welcoming people from the ferries and also just on the streets. But he's also goes to some of the bigger kind of events in town, like the Swim for Life is one example. So, yeah, he's really Like he's come up with his own slogans, as he said, and he's kind of figured it out for himself.
So this is he's still on the job another few days. So if you see him in Provincetown, be sure to say hi.
Right on. Yeah, his last day is Sunday, I think he's, as far as I can tell, people are really starting to kind of talk to him about saying goodbye and everything. So I think it'll be kind of a poignant. He did work for the Pilgrim Monument, then that transferred over to the Chamber of Provincetown Chamber of Commerce. They sent out a press release, so there's like tons of news out there about him leaving. So I think Sunday will be a big day for him.
That is Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nantucket has a youth hostel, but not for very much longer. The historic property is up for sale. Josh Bowling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us to talk about what might happen next. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the Egan Shipwreck Museum is a bidder on this property. Explain how they could see this as part of their mission. This is kind of one of the focuses of your story here.
Right. The Egan Maritime Institute, which operates the Nantucket Shipwreck and Lifesaving Museum, has decided to pursue the purchase of the Star of the Sea Youth Hostel, which Hosteling International announced about 2 weeks ago that it was putting on the market for $4.5 million. The hostel, which is on the south side of the island, just across the street from Surfside Beach, is the only hostel on the island, but it was also the its buildings were the remnants of the last remaining life-saving station on the island. And the Egan Maritime Institute's decision to pursue the purchase, they say, is not about maintaining the property as a hostel, but about preserving that maritime history. They did come into the game a little bit late, however. The deal is probably going to happen in the next week or so. At least it looks like that. Bids on the property were due this week. And Egan officials even 2 weeks ago said that the cost of the property, the asking price of $4.5 million, would probably preclude them from pursuing it, but they changed their minds, saying they didn't want to see this historic property converted into a luxury vacation home. They thought that perhaps if they do are successful in making the purchase, that they could convert it into exhibit space and educational center to complement their existing Shipwreck and Lifesaving Museum on Pulpit Road. It'll be interesting to see what happens there, though. The real estate agent that is handling the sale for the Maury People Real Estate Office said they hope to have a successful bidder identified within about a week. Hosteling International has said that they are interested in reaching out to island nonprofits and other organizations that might be able to keep the property, but at the end of the day, it's about the business, it's about the bottom line, and it's part of a larger financial decision they're making to close 8 hostels around the country, including one in Easton.
Mm. Let me ask you about another story you've got in the paper this week about Portuguese men of war, which have been sighted in Nantucket waters. Their numbers appear to be increasing.
They certainly do. It's not uncommon to see the occasional man of war around Nantucket this time of year, end of August, beginning of September, but the sheer number this year is unusual. Over the past week, dozens of them have been spotted from the south side of the island to the north side, even into the harbor in the Nantucket Boat Basin, which is also a little bit unusual. Nantucket is in the midst of peak jellyfish season, even though men of war are technically not jellyfish, with Atlantic sea nettles and lion's mane jellyfish all over the place. The annual daily beach report that goes out from the harbor master's office warns swimmers and beachgoers of jellyfish at just about every beach. The issue with the Portuguese men of war, however, is that they're incredibly venomous. Their stings are far more painful than the sea nettles and the lion's manes, and their tentacles can average 30 feet in length or longer. So bathers, boaters, kayakers in the harbor all are being advised to be on the lookout for Portuguese men of war and jellyfish in general. But if there is any good news, it's that the temperature is cooling down a little bit or expected to cool down a little bit. They probably won't be here too much longer, and visitors are also starting to leave, so the beaches aren't quite as crowded, but they are still here and be on the lookout.
That is Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard is seeing a boom in real estate that appears to be linked to the pandemic. It's got real implications for the island. Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, you talked to a number of different people about this, from second homeowners to real estate agents. Tell us what you heard and what's happening here.
Sure. So the pandemic has definitely contributed to this kind of unprecedented real estate market on the island that is not only seeing increased sale prices for homes and rapid buying of homes, but also, as you said, people who have owned homes here staying, seasonal visitors staying for longer than they usually would. For instance, I spoke to one man, John Siffert. He's a New York-based lawyer, and he's owned a home in West Tisbury for several years now, and usually only visits in the month of August, you know, in the height of summer. And he's been here since March, and he's probably going to stay through October.
So the idea that some homeowners are staying longer is part of this. There also seems to be a lot of people who are not selling their primary residences, but kind of shifting primary residence to secondary residences.
Yeah, so I spoke to a couple people at Link, which is this listing service for homes in Boston, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket. And they collect data on homes that are sold and everything like that. And Deborah Taylor, who's the president, who I spoke to, told me that she's seeing this new trend called second primary homes, which is basically they're not seeing a decrease in inventory in Boston. So what that's telling them is that people are keeping, you know, their homes in the cities, but they are kind of upscaling and buying homes on the vineyard. And it's this new, it's not necessarily a vacation home, but it's not necessarily a new home. It's kind of between.
Second primary homes. Okay.
Yeah.
For an island that already has an affordable housing and a housing issue, this is probably not helping matters for a lot of people.
Right. So with this rapid buying, it's also a stark reminder of the island's housing issues. And the island has, for many years, had issues with affordable and workforce housing anyways. But now you see this rapid buying of real estate, which is putting even more pressure on that affordable workforce housing stock. Couple that with the pandemic, with the difficulty in getting people to work, back to work, and businesses closing, it's proving a big issue for the island.
How about the schools? Are families staying, putting their children in local schools? Is this part of the picture too here?
So what's interesting is I spoke to a couple of realtors on the island, and I asked them if these people buying, these families buying, were asking about the schools. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the families have been asking, you know, what are the schools like? How many are there? And a lot of the realtors are saying that there is a heightened interest in the school system. But what's interesting about that is we also talked to several of the school principals on the island, you know, at the elementary schools and high school. And they say, you know, as far as they're concerned, enrollment is steady. It's similar to last year. And if anything, some of the schools reported that they're actually below enrollment. So we'll see how it turns out in the fall.
You also took a look at what this real estate crunch and shift in real estate could mean for elder services. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I spoke to Patty Moore, who is part of Healthy Aging Martha's Vineyard and an advocate for the elder community. And she told me that, you know, along with the housing, the pressure on housing, affordable housing, workforce housing, there could be a potential impact on services if these people that are rapidly buying up homes here end up staying. You know, usually you have these second homeowners who stay for their month in the summer, but then they're gone for the rest of the year. So they help pay for these services on the island, but they don't use them. But now we might see that. And with this increase, if there's a significant increase in population, those people would use services, which would take up more space for people who depend on them year round.
And then finally, you also checked in with the folks at the land bank because they also have a stake in how the whole real estate market is working there. Explain that for us.
Yeah, the Martha's Vineyard Land Bank is a conservation/preservation organization, and they get their revenue from a 2% transfer fee that is placed on all real estate transactions on the island. So they have been getting 2% of of everything that's been going through this summer. And just to also mention, there's been 292 real estate transactions on the island from March through August. And the land bank has seen upwards almost $1 million in revenue. But what's interesting is that the land bank executive director, James Lindell, told me that it's kind of apples and oranges for them. The real estate market certainly affects them, but they are always looking at wholesale land, which is more raw land, as opposed to retail land, which is developed, might have a house on it, something like that. So he did acknowledge that, you know, he's always looking at the real estate market and trends like that, but the land bank is usually looking at this kind of untapped, untouched land.
Hmm. That is Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, it's a fascinating story about all the implications that this has. You can find that story in the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good one.
We welcome back to the program right now CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hey, Steve.
Jeanette, another story I wanted to ask you about this morning. The Chamber announced a new marketing campaign, and it's launching now at the end of summer. Tell us about this.
Right. So extending the season, that is the name of the game for them. They're calling this Second Summer. And the idea is to bring people, of course, to the Cape through at least September and October and extend the tourist season that way, bring, of course, some revenue to the Cape. They're hoping that the differences in people's schedules, the school schedule being shaken up, and maybe some pent-up demand for travel from earlier in the year, that's going to bring people to the Cape, create interest in a little bit more travel, especially if we have warm weather going into the early part of the fall. And so they've created this Second Summer marketing campaign, and a big component of it is going to be digital billboards in Connecticut and along the Mass Pike for drivers out there to see that the Cape is ready to welcome them into the fall.
And still open for business, yes.
Right.
I want to ask you about one other story that you had an opportunity to cover this week, and it's a science story, and it has to do with a new piece of equipment being installed in the Cape Cod Canal. Explain a little bit what happened this week.
Right, this is a pretty cool science story. So there's an ocean technology company called Coastal Ocean Vision, which was founded by people from Hui, and they have developed a particle sensor. It was installed this week on this platform called the Bourne Tidal Test Site, which is basically looks like some metal structure in the water next to the railroad bridge on the Cape Cod Canal. So the sensor is underwater and it goes up to a solar panel that powers it and some instrumentation for recording and so forth that's up out of the water. And it's being used for two things. For Coastal Ocean Vision, their interest is in microplastics. So, of course, tiny particles of plastic that could be flowing into Buzzards Bay, potentially from as far away as Boston Harbor at the wastewater plant at Deer Island there. So they are involved in a study for that, and they're also developing and commercializing this technology. The other partner in this is the Marine Renewable Energy Collaborative. That's a nonprofit group, and they're the ones who developed, built this structure in the water. For their part, they're kind of interested in the, turbines, ocean-based turbines for renewable energy, and they are interested in studying plankton and how plankton could be used for defouling of underwater equipment, to removing buildup on underwater equipment. So this equipment.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going on and on.
I was just
going
to say, this sensor is going to be monitoring for both microplastics and plankton, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of like an amazing piece of technology because it takes in some water and looks at the water microscopically, and then it can identify automatically, you know, what's in that sample, record it up in the instrumentation that's above water, and then it sends out the data in what they call near real time to the researchers.
That's going to be operating now in the Cape Cod Canal for a time. That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Steve.
Election season is officially here now that we have the Massachusetts primary in the rearview mirror. It really was a rather quiet primary in terms of the number of contested races, but there was something exciting about it nonetheless. CAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean about how state officials think primary day went. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
We're seeing reports, even in the national press, that the primary overall in Massachusetts on Tuesday was pretty smooth. What did Secretary of State Bill Galvin have to say about it?
Yeah, I spoke to Galvin earlier in the week, and he said that, you know, things did go fairly smoothly. He said it was a success for Massachusetts, a success for democracy, especially at a time like this during the pandemic. His key point was, yes, there were some administrative hiccups, and we heard complaints about confusion over mail-in ballots, especially surrounding how to drop off those mail-in ballots. Essentially, if people couldn't get them mailed back to their city or town hall soon enough, each town had their own plan as to how to run a drop-off box, or people were confused about if they could bring their mail-in ballot to their normal polling station and just drop it off there, which they couldn't because it had to be centralized at town hall. Things like that were kind of a problem. There were some administrative hiccups, obviously, but all in all, we had, you know, over 1.5 million. That's an estimate right now. We won't know the exact number until things are finalized, but around 1.5 million votes. We haven't seen something like that in years and years. I think that's competitive with the 1990 primary, which was the last time we had a turnout that large. So it's been, you know, record-setting or close to, and that's got to be seen as a success for voter participation.
I know there were definitely some concerns here on the Cape from town clerks about just the sheer workload and ballots being delivered on time, but it does seem that overall it was fairly smooth.
And that was one of Galvin's key points, was when you're making it easier on voters, which is what we're doing right now during this pandemic, this is also the first time that early voting was allowed in a primary race. By making it easier on voters, you're making it harder on those elections administrators. And so that's kind of where the conflict sits in. And you're absolutely right. Those town and city clerks really took the brunt of it. That's where, you know, some of the falling down may have occurred there. But all in all, the success of the number of votes shows that did okay.
And I think we can have a little more confidence heading into the general election in November, because now town clerks have a little bit of time to gear up as the state prepares ballots for the general election.
Exactly. You know, Galvin kept saying over and over again that the main event is the November election, and that's true. However, in Massachusetts, our primary elections are really what decides, you know, which Democrats are going to represent us. Usually that's how it goes. Of course, we're going to have a competitive race for U.S. Senate between Kevin O'Connor, the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, who's going to face Ed Markey in the general election. But Markey is heavily favored to keep the seat blue in the U.S. Senate. And the same goes for the other congressional races, where, you know, Republicans just aren't favored nearly as heavily as Democrats are. So yes, the November election and the presidential race is the main event. But when it comes down to who is going to be elected, those primary races are extremely important for a state like Massachusetts. So we're seeing it as a learning experience. Like you say, those clerks and the secretary's office itself are going to learn a lot and make changes. And his number one piece of advice was get those mail-in ballots in the mail early, especially if you already know who you're going to vote for president on down, which I think a lot of voters in Massachusetts already do. Then get those ballots in the mail. That's what Galvin said.
You mentioned the Markey Kennedy race. With Markey, he does have a challenger on the Republican side, but for the primary, the Markey Kennedy Senate race was probably the most watched race statewide, and it got national attention, and at times it looked close, but Markey did end up winning by a fair enough margin.
Right. Markey had a pretty big victory against Joe Kennedy pretty much across the state. A lot of, you know, Boston and Boston suburbs, if you take a look at the communities that went for Markey, you saw, you know, big numbers in Western Massachusetts and huge numbers in the Boston and suburban Boston, greater Boston area. So that is how you win in Massachusetts. That's, you know, how it goes. And yeah, it's getting a lot of national attention. Obviously, it's a U.S. Senate seat. It's a Kennedy. A lot of folks are saying that Joe Kennedy's not done. You know, he's a young guy. I think he's 38, 39 years old. He can certainly come back and do something else politically if that is his want. But, you know, you're seeing a lot of folks saying that, you know, Markey himself said voters were voting for change. And for some reason, that change comes in the package of a guy who's been there for 42 years in Congress. But, you know, the Markey campaign did a great job reaching out to younger voters and making it kind of a policy first thing and portraying Ed Markey as the guy who can get these change policies done. So even though you're not changing out the figure in Congress, Markey, you know, successfully portrayed himself as an agent of change who can go to D.C. and get things like the Green New Deal, which he's a co-sponsor of, going in you know, something like the next administration.
You mentioned before, you know, Massachusetts likes their incumbents and did this primary especially. There were some challenges to House Speaker Robert DeLeo's leadership team, but it looks like he's come out pretty much intact.
Yeah, there's no changes to DeLeo's leadership team, even though 11 of them were challenge. That's, you know, either floor leaders or chairman of different committees under DeLeo. Every single one of them will be returning. They defeated all of their challengers on Tuesday. And that's important because really the only incumbents that lost on Tuesday, out of the 200 legislators, there was one state senator who was upset in the Springfield area and one state representative from Lowell who's currently under federal indictment and fighting those charges. So yeah, this is incumbents ran the show basically on Tuesday. They're all going back, you know, at a time like this and in a campaign season like this where you can't get out in really campaign style that people are used to. These incumbents really do have the advantage, and the machines they've built up over the years have the advantage to, you know, win in a mail-in situation like this.
That is CAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. That was CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean from the Statehouse there. That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times, CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We heard from Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and checked in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Mike Dean there up at the State House. A big thanks to our Dan Tridle back at the studio. His job is to make it seem like there's no panic, no confusion, even when everything's on fire behind the scenes. Good job today, Dan. And thanks to my family for letting me make all the noise in the house for 1 hour. You can now turn on the blender, kids. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.